This is the DRF Players Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the May 11th edition of the DRF Players Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornital, back with you, with the usual crew, at DRF Formulator Mike Hogan, and at UT Big Hair Jonathan Kinchin. How are you two guys doing today?
Doing well.
This is always a rough week for me.
Wow, he sounds depressed. Listen to him. That's not good. Somebody, we got to send him some cookies. Do something.
Well, it was always such a big buildup leading into to Derby, and then when it's over, it's like, oh, now it's over. And it's last year I had had a couple of extra dollars laying around that made the pain a little bit better. Unfortunately, this year that those dollars didn't come back on the plane from Louisville.
No rubber bands this year?
No rubber bandless. Rubber bandless.
We'll talk about all that in a second. I want to talk about the big story of Saturday. I'm, of course, referring to 42-year-old Bartolo Colon hitting his first Major League home run for the Mets. No, that wasn't the big news of Saturday. No, of course, the big news of Saturday was Nyquist. There were some doubts coming in, not from the public, mind you, not from the people who actually bet money. There wasn't many doubts, him coming in as a 2-1 favorite, shorter than American Pharoah. But it seemed like every corner we looked in, certainly on our show and in various pundits across the internet and television, there was some doubts about this horse. Am I correct to say that Nyquist silenced them all at about 6:45 p.m. Saturday night in Louisville, Kentucky? Mike?
I think so. I think, look, he set off a hot pace. The pace pretty much collapsed for the pace setter Dancing Candy, for almost everybody else that was on or near the pace with him. He beat Gunrunner, even though Gunrunner held on for third, he beat him easily. He held off all the closers. This is a horse that just wins. He's now 8-for-8. You can doubt him all you want, but at least this crew that he's faced so far, he's the best in my mind. I mean, I didn't see anything. Sometimes you see a horse that had some trouble and was by far the best, even though they didn't win. I didn't see that in this Derby.
Jonathan, before we get to your take on this race, I want to take a step back and listen to the stretch call. Here's Travis Stone.
Mohamed has started to make some progress out of 8th. Oscar Nominated is 9th. My Man Sam is 10th. More Spirit is 11th. Exaggerator's trying to pick through the pack. Had to check off heels there. Tries to find a seam toward the inside. There's a quarter mile to go in the Kentucky Derby. They turn for home. And here's Nyquist. Champion Nyquist comes off the turn and takes the lead away from Gunrunner. It's these two clear by 5. Mohamed's closing on the outside. And Exaggerator's flying down the center of the track by the Twin Spires in the Kentucky Derby. It's Nyquist clear by 3. Gunrunner's running in second. Exaggerator continues to close. Time is running out. Nyquist is 100 yards from home. Exaggerator with one final try in the Derby. Nyquist holds on. He's undefeated, and he's won the 142nd Kentucky Derby. Exaggerator was second. Sudden breaking news, Mohamed and Gunrunner in a photo for 3rd, 4th, and 5th.
I think I'm comfortable saying Mr. Stone is 2-for-2 in his Derby calls. It's the first time I've heard that one, and it sounds good. He captured the excitement, and he captured the dominance of Nyquist. Jonathan, you came into this race, I think, certainly higher on Nyquist than me as a betting opportunity. What is your overall take on Derby 142?
Yeah, I think that the profile for a horse in which horse players are willing to take short prices on, for some reason they just felt there was missing a couple things with Nyquist, and I paid the price. I used him defensively, but my defense got even worse as the day went on, and I just I got beat. It's a sad story when you have such a great opinion in the race before that I had with the Vicedero, and I didn't really cash anything. So I think he's proven. Based on the performance he had with that pace, that he's definitely deserved. He was the deserving favorite without a doubt. He's a deserving favorite moving forward, and a horse that deserves a conversation that a lot of people are giving him on his chances of potentially winning in Baltimore and then is at Belmont Park in 5 weeks.
My buddy Gil Alexander was kind enough to have me on his show, the Beating the Book podcast, last week on Thursday, and he asked me he asked this question in a really interesting way. He sort of had asked if I thought there would be a Triple Crown winner this year, and I said I thought there wouldn't be. And he said, well, if there winds up being a Triple Crown winner, like, what are we going to be, what would your reaction be knowing what you know now? And my answer to that was, and it ends up being a little prophetic, I said, well, I guess in that case, Nyquist would be a heck of a lot better horse than I gave him credit for. And I think that he did show that in the way that he won. And Jonathan and Mike both make the point that this was not some candy pace great setup here. This was a final time figure that I think you can upgrade based on how fast the race was early. I did think, unlike, there's been a lot of debate really about whether or not this track was a speed favoring track. Watching the races live, it was my observation that I didn't think there was as much closing in the overall context of a race as I expected to see given some of the paces on Saturday. So that was my sort of initial bias. So there's a couple of different sources that mathematically represent whether or not there's a bias. The first ones I looked at had the track as totally fair. One that I trust very much did have it as a speed favoring track. That's the data from Racing Flow, had the track as significantly favoring speed on Saturday. So I'm tempted to, between that and my initial opinion, say that I my overall read is going to be that the track was kind of speed. But despite that, the pace was such in the Nyquist race that at worst it was a neutral situation, and he may still even deserve an upgrade for where he was. Jonathan, what's your take on how the track was playing on Saturday and how that affects your view of Nyquist?
Yeah, you know, I think it's one of those situations where it's not cut and dry. I think that we won't know what the track was until we see some of these horses run back. And I know that seems like kind of a wishy-washy answer, but, you know, I got to know what Sharp Azteca does. I mean, I got to know if that horse is the next run happy and he's a freak, and if he goes 4-for-4 in his next four starts, then there's a possibility that the track was fair. If he falls apart next time and proves that 44 half holding off those horses wasn't what we thought it was, then, you know, I think that'll kind of tell a little bit more of a story. So I want to see what Nyquist does going out of this. I want to see what Sharp Azteca does going out of this before I can really decide how I feel like the track was playing.
Mike already mentioned that he didn't see, I think he was basically saying that he didn't see any big trips coming out of the Derby of horses that he thought could at least come back and threaten Nyquist anytime soon. Is that your view as well, Jonathan? Is there a horse or a trip that you saw in the Derby, somebody you're looking to bet back sooner rather than later?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest trip, in my opinion, was the trip of Nyquist. And he got the worst trip, in my opinion, chasing that fast pace. And so he's the type of horse, if it was a Wednesday or Thursday at Belmont, that I would be looking to bet back.
All right, well, speaking of betting Nyquist back, I have to admit, I did not look at the news stories this morning. As of now, Mike, who is expected to come back and face this horse in Baltimore?
Well, I think there's a few from the Derby. It came out that Alani is expected to go in the, not just the Preakness, but the Belmont as well. I'm going to be honest. He ran much, much better than I thought he would. He finished eighth. He finished in the top half of the field, which is more than I gave him credit for going into the race. And he actually made an okay middle move after lagging pretty far back early. I don't think he can threaten, but there's going to be some people that bet on him. I think there's a lot of people that think, oh, closing in the Derby means that they're alive in the Belmont. And if that's what you think, then maybe Lonnie's your horse, but I'm going to be going a completely different way in the Belmont than that opinion.
In all fairness, Pete, I'm with you. I attempted to laugh, too, and I looked down at the chart and realized that Lonnie finished in front of 5 horses that I used in my 8-horse superfecta box, and a horse that you had, a future win bet on. So he's laughing at us a little bit.
You're not wrong, though. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that was more about those horses not being up to snuff than it is about Lonnie being a legitimate classic contender. That said, given some of the angst he he showed in the morning, if he gets his mind on business and keeps it in his pants, who knows how good Lonnie could be.
For sure. So I think he's going to go. They've already said that some horses that didn't make the Derby, like Lauban, will be going. Jonathan, I know, is very high on Stradivari. He'll be going. Pletcher hasn't mentioned anybody else, so I don't know if Destin or Outwork is likely to show up. I think we're going to have a few other. Exaggerator is the word is he's going. On the fence with horses like Gunrunner. Brody's Cause, they may or may not go. So you'll get a few back from the Derby, but in my mind, Nyquist has beaten all these horses. He's beaten some of them multiple times, including Exaggerator. There is nothing that I've seen that makes me think that that's going to change next Saturday, and I think the biggest threat is going to be someone jumping up that has never faced him before.
Jonathan, when we were sitting in the green room at Keeneland a few weeks ago on the Sunday of their contest, there was a performance on that day, and afterward you said, not entirely sarcastically, I think we just saw the Preakness winner.
Yeah, I mean,
standing by that belief, or have cooler heads prevailed?
You know, I guess for the sake of the show and my pride, I'll say yes. But then when the betting comes around, we'll see. You know, Mike actually mentioned in our kind of pre-production conversation today that he thought the horse was going to be overbet. I don't think the horse will be overbet. But if Mike's right about that, then he's definitely not one that I'd be interested in looking at.
Talking about Stradivari for Todd Pletcher, who had many folks' eyeballs popping out of the head. Was sort of the talk of Lexington before the race. And actually ran to that rather impressively. Now, I hate doing this because we don't know who's in the race yet. But Mike, part of me thinks, oh, let's just wait and talk about this later. I also see a universe in which the horse shows up in the Peter Pan this Saturday rather than the Preakness. So, Mike, what do we know about this horse, and what price are you guessing he's going to be that you think he's going to be such an underlay?
Here's what we know about this horse. He's 2-for-3 lifetime. He's 2-for-2 in routes on dirt. His two wins were by 11.25 lengths and 14.5 lengths. He's coming off of that last race where he got a buyer of 100 at Keeneland, going two turns at a mile and an eighth. He's Todd Pletcher. He's John Velasquez. He is the horse that everybody's going to be leaning on if they're thinking, look, Nyquist has handled Exaggerator a bunch of times. Exaggerator is the logical second choice, but I don't want to bet him. He's the one that everyone's going to gravitate toward as the newcomers looking to knock Nyquist off the throne. He's going to be way overbet from that standpoint because they're going to look at it and say, this is a horse could be an absolute monster. And it's like Jonathan says all the time, you want to bet on what you know and not what could be. And I think a lot of people are going to be hoping, especially since there were all those doubters. And some of the first things I saw after the Derby was, okay, now who am I going to look to in the Preakness to bet against Nyquist? There's a lot of people looking for somebody to bet against Nyquist because the doubters are still out there. And I think they're going to land on Stradivari.
I had the exact opposite reaction to Nyquist. Derby win. That's interesting. I didn't see much of that, but I was pretty much just avoiding Twitter. It was a frustrating day of betting, and it had been a bunch of days of doing nothing but racing stuff, and I kind of needed a break, so I didn't do the full round of deconstructing that I normally do. But to me, watching the race, I agree with what both Mike and Jonathan said. This does not look to me like a horse that you want to that I'm like rushing to oppose. So that's interesting to me. The horse that I was thinking, and I don't even know if he's going to be in the race, but that Baffert horse, Collected, has run pretty well. I was seeing him as sort of the second choice that everybody would gravitate towards over a horse like Stradivari. Jonathan, what do you know about that horse, and how would you evaluate either of those two new shooters' chances against the big horse?
Yeah, I mean, I heard, I think, what a lot of other people heard, especially the people that follow the racing forum as closely as we do, that, you know, Mike Welsh said that, you know, every year there's been that derby work, that, you know, Animal Kingdom, Barbaro, Rachel Alexandra, American Pharoah, and this year, from what I've heard, it was Collected, and the way that he worked leading into the week of the Derby was supposedly phenomenal, and so apparently he's coming into this race and and in peak form. I think that he'll get ignored on the board with some of the bigger names. I think Exaggerator obviously will get bet, Nyquist, Stradivari. I think that you know, Collected actually could be ignored on the board, maybe at 8, 9, 10 to 1.
So even I, who think Exaggerator was maybe up against it from a way the track was playing perspective, even I am not in a hurry to take him. Or I mean, I don't even – I think I'd use him in maybe the thinnest of backups going against Nyquist yet again, a horse who's handled him so many times. But you think there's a chance that the betting public will say, oh, well, he was closing last time, maybe he'll get there today? I mean, you see some serious market support for Exaggerator, Jonathan?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think he was embraced pretty heavily going into the race. And then moving forward, I think that, you know, I think most people's core, my biggest question was that he's a one-turn horse. I still actually think he's a one-turn horse. He just got a setup again in terms of pace. But, yeah, I think he'll get bet off of that. Just, you know, running second in the Derby, looks like he was getting to Nyquist late. I think there'll be some support for him there, especially if horses like Lauban, Stradivari, Awesome Speed, all these other speed types show up here, it'll be even more certain that the pace will be quick. I think people could lean in that direction.
Couple of observations.
I think a lot of people.
You go ahead, Mike.
Sorry, I was going to say, I think I'm exaggerating. I think a lot of people think, oh, okay, he was getting there at 10 furlongs. 12 furlongs is maybe the better option. I hope they skip the Preakness and target the Belmont for him. And I think a lot of people will think, oh, you know, shorter, slightly shorter in the Preakness is not where I want Exaggerator. Oftentimes, though, for a deep closer like that, it's completely the opposite, and longer just kind of dulls that closing kick. But we'll see. I think that within Exaggerator, this is a horse that if you look at his PPs, he's got Nyquist in there four times. He's 4-for-4 against Nyquist, 4-for-4 against Exaggerator. I think that a lot of people are going to say, okay, I'm done with him. Now who can I find for as a new shooter to upset Nyquist? And that's why I think, I don't think he's going to be second choice, but I think Stradivari could be very similar in the wagering to Exaggerator.
That's a story we'll obviously be following a lot over the next couple of weeks. I had a couple other points generally about the Derby I wanted to make. One, I'm just going to ask you guys a true or false. This was something that I'm toying with really incorporating into my handicapping in general, and especially when it comes to the classic races next year. But really, this is just a general thought I have about American racing, especially American dirt racing. I'll ask you, Mike, as a true or false, but I'll let you expand. I won't cut you off like I did Chris Larmy the other week. Distance has never meant less. Like the theoretical ability to get the distance has never meant less in American dirt racing. True or false, Mike?
I guess I'll say true. Do you want me to expand, or do you want Jonathan to
answer? You can leave it there. You can leave it there. I want somebody to disagree with me because that'll be more entertaining. I can make the true point myself. Jonathan?
Yeah, no, I think false. I think it still matters. You know, I mean, you and I are obviously, you know, card-carrying supporters of Uncle Mo, the Uncle Mo fan club. So I don't think that Nyquist – I don't think we know what Uncle Mo is going to produce as a sire. And so Nyquist is, you know, not – ideal pedigree for getting, you know, 10 furlongs doesn't really dissuade me much. I still believe in it. I still think it's very important. I still think that you know, racing in America is very heavily influenced by breeding, and I don't think that anything happened this weekend has changed how I feel about that.
I'm not saying that breeding doesn't matter so much as I think there's something to be said for horses producing other qualities than what is typically perceived as like a stoutness for getting the distance that seemed to shine. When I was looking back at Exaggerator's PPs after the race and seeing, Nyquist PPs after the race and seeing, but I mean really Exaggerator too to another degree, seeing how well they had done at races going shorter, at 7 furlongs, say, and applying some of those numbers, they seem to be able to replicate them like, you know, the 3 extra furlongs seem to throw a wrench in the works at all. The race, though, that I think I was thinking of way more than the Derby, because I agree, Jonathan, after seeing Uncle Mo a few weeks ago and seeing how he looks as an adult, you know, I mean, we got to remember, these horses at 3 and 4, they're still like a essentially late juveniles, high school kids, early 20s. Seeing him as a grown man and knowing that those are his genetics to look like that, like a poster, like a paint, like a oil painting in the Louvre of a racehorse, of a stallion, with how big his lungs were, how tall he was, no doubt in my mind, and I'm a little annoyed that I didn't factor this into more of my betting, no doubt in my mind that that animal would be capable of producing runners to go long in the classic sense. So in a way, I was thinking about Exaggerator, thinking a little bit about Nyquist, but definitely thinking about the Oaks the day before and Catherine Sophia, a horse who I just didn't think, I feel so silly after the fact. I was sitting on some nice tickets and did not use because I didn't think she wanted to go that far. That was the other result that was making me question just how much attention I will often pay to a horse. You know, Exaggerator last time, Catherine Sophia this time. I'm throwing out these horses who fit in every way except some vague non-mathematical sense in my own head that they don't want to go this far. I just don't think I want to do that anymore. I think I want to bet on these horses based on their pace and speed figures more than I do some ethereal sense of how far they want to run or what a trainer might have said. Mike, you think I'm on to something with that, or do you take Jonathan's point?
No, absolutely. And, well, I will come at it at slightly a different way. I use pedigree handicapping for horses that I haven't really seen run before, first-time starters, if they're debuting sprinting on the dirt, but their siblings and dam have all had success going long on the turf, that is still very useful to me. I mean, when you say that's why I hesitated a little while to answer your question, because I still think that stuff does matter. However, with a horse like
specifically about dirt, I agree with you about turf. By the way, that's a whole separate conversation. Just to
okay, fair enough. But with a horse like Nyquist, and we can even say American Pharoah last year, whose brother couldn't outrun a fat man, and whose dam didn't seem to want to go very far herself, and even California Chrome the year before, these are horses who, once they've proven it to me on the track, I don't really care whether or not their pedigree says they want to stop at 8 furlongs or whether they can get 10 furlongs or whatever. None of that matters in dosage to me. I think if you ask the question, just dosage and that approach to handicapping the Derby mattered less than ever before, I would say absolutely. And that was why I thought Nyquist was the most likely winner. I didn't care. He'd shown it to me at every distance. He'd shown it to me in every situation, stalking the lead, far off the pace, on the lead. This is a horse that visually I saw as one that had speed, had ability to carry the speed. And to me, that is more of a factor than something like dosage or something like who's the best bred for the distance, because frankly, the best bred three-year-old for the distance you could argue is maybe a horse like Zyconic, who is just not that fast. I'll take a fast horse over a horse bred for 10 furlongs any day of the week.
Well, there's something to be said for that. It's also, you look at the past few Derby winners and they back up that assertion as well. I don't mean to be mean. I like that people look at different things. I don't want everybody to look at the world the same way that I do. I think that's really boring. In fact, we'd have no sport if everybody did. But the one thing I'm going to be a little bit like, parochial? I don't know. I can't come up with the right word here about is dosage. I'd like to just say, I mean, granted, you hear it so much less than you did years ago. This is this mathematical formula that supposedly has some sort of prediction value about how far horses want to race. I'd like to say that maybe we can just never hear the term again. Jonathan, am I being too harsh?
I've barely touched on it, so it's not, I wouldn't feel fair if I talked negatively about it, but I don't consider it. But it's more of a non-consideration based on ignorance than it is on dislike.
Fair enough. How about your answer to the previous question I asked Mike? I mean, what I'm saying have the ring of truth to it at all about, I mean, maybe it's question. I'm not the distance doesn't matter. It's that I've been overrating it in my handicapping. I mean, what would your advice to me be as somebody sort of struggling, thinking he might be overrating this factor of how far he thinks horses want to go, as opposed to just looking at how fast they have gone and what I think they shape like?
Right, so I didn't really form an opinion on the question that you had, but I did answer the question as to why I tossed Catherine Sophia, and I looked back on the two races that have changed my handicapping opinion and will make me a better player moving forward, and that's the Travers from last year and the Ashland from this year. When horses run 46-second middle halves, that is significant. And yep. It's the same thing that happened to American Pharoah and got him beat at the Travers, and it's the same thing that happened to Catherine Sophia and the Ashland, and I can promise you I won't make that mistake again. When horses run middle 46s, it means something, it's significant, and it's very hard for horses to go on in those situations when they have good horses running at them late, and that's what I took from it, and I'll be sure to appreciate that moving forward.
It's hard because sometimes when you're talking about internal fractions, they can get lost looking at the overall pace figures. And Formulator lets you do this in the chart feature, where you can look at exactly what quarters that horses were running at the different stages of the race. For example, in the Ashland, it's not that the first quarter was so fast. It was that those middle furlongs that Jonathan's talking about, I think, that really showed why that race set up to be a collapse. Some pace figure systems, like the racing flow data, caught that and made Catherine Sophia a clear upgrade. Some other pace data I was looking at, it wasn't nearly as evident. So I think that's, you know, it's a bit down the rabbit hole, pace handicapping type stuff. But I think really breaking down the internal fractions of a race, maybe even making your own pace figures, this is why it's important, because it can help point you to things. And I guess that's my point. Like, I guess I believe in that stuff. I knew that was the case going in, and I should have deferred to that, the sort of harder handicapping data, the digging that I was doing, rather than some sort of ethereal sense of how far the horse would go.
Yeah, I think the very simple way that I'm going to approach it moving forward is when I'm looking at a race, and I think it'll be pretty quick when I'm flying through a handicapping a race, and I see a horse that went 24 for the first quarter and was close to the pace or on the pace and didn't go on and win or ran a performance in which I'm questioning, then I'll just look back and just make sure that there wasn't that 46 middle in there, that I can now give that horse an excuse. And I think it'll be a pretty quick way to be able to double check where I don't fall in the situation where I let two horses that deserved an excuse get away from me in their next start.
Mike, yeah, let's talk about the doubts. Yeah, I do. Let's talk about the doubts about Catherine Sophia getting the distance. Is it primarily from what the trainer had said, or is it primarily from her pedigree, or is it both? Because, you know, at the risk of redboarding, I used like four horses or five horses in the Oaks. One of my only, you know, I had it a few times, but one of my only real successful bets was the Oaks Woodford Derby pick three, where I used Catherine Sophia, and I felt like at 9-2, and she was even higher than that in most of the wagering, she was an absolute overlay, because this was a horse who, just on the PPs, had made an early move into a hot pace in the Ashland the first time going two turns, and likely could improve the second time going two turns based on the brilliance that she had shown going shorter. But I think a lot of people questioned what Service said after the race, which is now we're going to cut back and go to the eight bells. And maybe because she's by Street Boss, who was primarily a sprinter and known more for sprinters, is that the reason? Or am I missing something?
I think for me, I mean, I think both are the reason. But I do think twice on this Triple Crown trail, I made sort of a cardinal mistake of taking a trainer too literally about a post-race quote. We all did it with Exaggerator. I remember we even joked about it on the show when O'Neill said after that prep race before the Santa Anita Derby.
You mean
not
DeSormo.
O'Neill. DeSormo said that the horse, maybe, I don't think he wants to go past a mile or whatever. We even joked on the show, oh, let's put that in our Formulator notes and never bet that horse going farther. That was one instance where I did that. And then again with the Catherine Sophia thing. Now, both those situations, I mean, look, I listen to trainer quotes. I put them in Formulator. They're certainly not gospel, especially not in this instance, especially not with the Catherine Sophia quote, because obviously all that was doing was ducking Songbird and just not wanting to come out and say, hey, we're going to duck Songbird, everybody. So why do I listen to that at all? It just, it makes me a little, it makes me a little concerned at my own mental capabilities.
I do think that, you know, and it came up a few times this weekend, and Pete, we've been around each other millions of times at the racetrack when it comes up. You know, I think it's a very simple phrase that, you know, you live by the info, you die by the info. And that goes for both. That goes for both sides. If you're getting, you know, trainer info, you know, jockey info, trainer talk, jockey talk, post race workout reports, you live by it, you die by it. And I think that in the long term, you're better off formulating an opinion based on other information that you can gather, and not just tossing it aside. You know, I think that there's I think moving forward, I'm going to continue to do the same thing I do. When I get information like that that I think is good, I'm going to use it. And I just need to also incorporate other things to maybe avoid making those mistakes.
I think that's good. I think that's really good advice.
I'll say this, and I think those two examples have kind of bear it out. The trainers obviously see the horse on a daily basis, and they know more about the horse than you or I do as one sitting thousands of miles away, potentially, looking at a computer screen or looking at paper. That said, they are not they're guessing as well. Until the horse actually does something, they don't know if she's going to be successful at two turns as she was at one turn, or if Exaggerator can get more than a mile, or maybe they're just sandbagging a little bit. You know, I mean, you think about Todd Pletcher and his quotes. He is a master at saying absolutely nothing when he answers a question. And sometimes these trainers, they're not necessarily the best handicappers either, and they don't know until it actually happens. And, you know, with
Mike, are you suggesting that a trainer from Louisiana might be saying something other than what was the absolute truth? Is that what you're saying?
I'm not saying that, but I'm not saying that that's wildly impossible. So, you know, I mean, let's look at Catherine Sophia. She's by street boss, sure, but she's the first foal out of an unraced mineshaft dam. You know, mineshaft certainly had no problem going two turns. You've got her dam. So Catherine Sophia's second dam is a horse named Belterra, who has won. She won a number of stakes races. She won the Ashland. She won the Goldenrod. She was a very good one. She could go two turns, no problem. I don't see the doubts from a pedigree standpoint, and I think a lot of people were just putting so much faith on what Service was saying, because even in the Ashland, if you say, boy, that's a horse that looks like it doesn't want to go that far, it's the first time she was trying it. You know, Jonathan mentioned the middle splits like that. Those are the kinds of moves you upgrade, not down.
I think I know. This has been good. This has been a good therapy session. I should send you both a check for the 50-minute hour here, because I've come away with something, and it's just sort of a rejiggering of priorities. And this is the way that I like to handicap anyway, where you take all the information and you don't throw out the baby with the bathwater, but the way that you process your information is you defer to the fundamentals. And for me, the fundamentals are always going to be speed, pace, class, and form, and things like trainer information, things like guesses about the breeding. It's not that they don't matter, and maybe they can help separate contenders, but you don't take a horse that fits on paper and throw them because of a secondary piece of information. Maybe you downgrade them a little bit. Maybe then it wasn't such a weekend of wagering pain. Speaking of wagering pain, Jonathan, people, to you and I both on Twitter, sent us messages after Camelot Kitten won, after Divisadero won, just assuming that we were rolling in money, that the rubber bands were out. I know what happened to me. What happened to you?
You know, it's just one of those things where, you know, when we do this show, you know, sometimes we get out ahead of ourselves, and then once you really kind of sit down and have to start making decisions, you think, Lee. And plus, like on the show, like I don't want to give just some chalk horse all the time. I pick enough chalk, and so sometimes I want to give ideas that make people feel a little bit better about thinking and da da da. And long story short, I'm spinning. Long story short, I just used the horse Camelot Kitten defensively. I didn't think the horse was fast enough. A conversation the night before about Chad Brown adding blinkers made me a little bit more skeptical on the horse. I fell in love with Beach Patrol, Shock-A-Mott, and Aero Force moving forward. I thought I could get away with just those three horses, and maybe Camelot Kitten would get a piece. And then here comes my the full brother to my favorite horse ever up the rail.
It was a very painful nose. It was a very painful nose. I'm in that pick four if that photo goes the other way. And then for me, I just tied too much money up into multis with the Visadero, and didn't have the money to bet him properly when the race came. So that one result, as much as I liked that horse, as much as we talked about that horse, that should have made it a winning weekend. Not anything huge, but it should have clawed me out. But no, I let that 6-1 shot basically get me back nothing significant. Very, very frustrating from a betting point of view. Mike, it sounds like you did a little bit better than us. What was your Derby experience in general? Where were you watching the race?
Oh, I was at home. My wife was working all day, and worked all day the next day on Mother's Day. So I was
That's
just
terrible, by the way. Kids, don't yeah, be well, a doctor. You know, go into horse playing. Leave these right. real jobs behind.
I was playing Mr. Mom, and you know, watching the races and playing a little bit of the races, but you know, I wasn't going too crazy. And you know, frankly I probably should have just left everything alone and let my Oaks Woodford Derby pick three ride, because then I probably would have done okay for the day.
Jonathan, betting aside, I want to hear about your Derby experience, specifically what interactions you had with the folks in the Kentucky Derby betting challenge. That's something I want to talk about for a minute.
Yeah, no, it was fun. It's always fun. I mean, Derby's amazing. I went with my buddy Robert Chow, played in the tournament. He always gets a table for six. I was lucky enough to get a credential, so we got to bring an extra friend along. We had a big group. We're running around, Ubering all over the place. And we went to the track Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and it was a blast. It's always fun. It's been fun to take new people to the Derby. You know, as a horse racing fan, if you want to get a friend of yours hooked on horse racing, take them to Santa Anita or take them to the Derby, and that should get the job done. So it was good. I mean, we had a good time. Robert made some noise on Friday a little bit in the tournament. I was trying to be as of assistance if I could, but he's got a good enough opinion on his own. We devised, laying around hungover on Saturday morning, a brilliant plan to go all in with his $7,500 bankroll with Teppan on top of a weighted trifecta. Robert's punching in the tickets. I look back and see they're still on the dirt. I tell him he's got time. And the nine, we don't get the bet in with the nine.
That's awful.
That would have taken him to about... would have taken him to about $12,000 there, and that was like the first hour we were at the racetrack on Saturday, and things just went progressively worse as the day went on.
It's hard to come back from that.
It was fun. We got to go up to the announcer's booth and watch our buddy Travis Stone call a few races. It's an unbelievable experience if you've never been before. It's the most fun you'll have walking around for 2 hours after the race, just trying to find a ride home that you could ever imagine.
And, no golf cart this year?
We did. We golf carted. We actually got the most gangster golf cart driver in America. He cut through grass, trees, sidewalks, ducked around cops. I mean, it was amazing.
Why wasn't this on Periscope? What are you doing to us?
There's two reasons. One, cell phone battery and mild depression. Those are the only two, only two reasons that it wasn't. So
totally fair. Did you have any dealings with the winner, Ron Myers?
I didn't. I saw him. We came up to the room afterwards. They had some popcorn up there, so we were starving. We snuck in there and grabbed some popcorn. But no, I didn't. I didn't have a chance to talk to him. I did talk to a friend of Duke Matisse who ran fourth, Keith. You know, I talked to him a little bit throughout his day. Yeah, Keith Smith. They hit. They had a big $400 exacto with the Divisadero World Approval race that got them back into action. Heard a few bad beat stories like we always do in those types of situations where a horse here, a horse there can really turn those things around. But it seemed like the tournament went well. I talked to Gary Palmisano, the director of the tournament, and you know, he had a couple of frustrating results with people. He had two people that didn't even show up that qualified. They're going to get their check for $15,000 in the mail, so that obviously affected their churn numbers, but they did well. They did better than they expected, and so looks like that tournament will probably be a force on the tour moving forward.
Speaking of the NHC Tour, a couple of events coming up. We've got qualifying events on DRF Qualify Saturday and Sunday. Next weekend, I'll be out at Santa Anita for their Preakness contest, and then June 4th at Monmouth, the Pick Your Prize contest. Go on to drfqualify.com to look for opportunities there. We've got a free contest that we're going to be hosting. If you check my Twitter, @loomsboldly, you'll see all the details. I believe that's going to be on the new DRF tournament platform, tournaments.drf.com, on Saturday. Chance to win your way into the NHC for free. A BC qualify action, NHC qualify action on Sunday as well. Make sure to check it out. Going to be a lot of fun as the NHC Tour starts to heat up. How about the performance lately, Jonathan, of Ken McMahon, who got yet another fourth on NHC qualify on Sunday after doing the same thing the week before? He's certainly one of the guys I have my eyes on as a potential player on the tour this year to give you a fight or even take your crown. What's your opinion of Kenny's tour chances at this point?
Well, first of all, there's not anyone else I can really think of that I'd be more proud to give to hand over the belt to. Don't get me wrong, I'm still going to try to go get it. But Ken's amazing. If you've never had a chance to speak with Ken and you're a tour player or a tournament player, make sure you go up and talk to him. He's unbelievable guy. He's one of the most generous men. He's great. And so, and I tell you what, he's dangerous. If you have your eyes set on winning the tour, you're going to have to deal with Ken because he's got a partner in crime and his wife, Jeannie King, and they like to get on airplanes and go play in tournaments. So he's not going to have any family things holding him back. He'll be able to run around and go to all the spots and all the places. And as he's shown with his performances so far this year, he's definitely dangerous. And one that'll definitely grab an outright win somewhere along the way to make it tough for people to try to catch him.
I'm going to be writing about Ken later this week. I've interviewed him the last 2 weeks, and he has another quality that I think is going to be very, very – make him a very, very dangerous player on the tour, and that is his experience in the poker world back in the early 90s. I mean, this is a guy who's had – he has some serious poker bona fides. He's had final table appearances and deep runs at the World Series of Poker back in the day. He told me he was hanging out with Chris Ferguson when his name was Chris, not Jesus, and he had stories about when Mattisau was his dealer at I think it was at Sam's Town. So I mean, he goes way back. But I think when you know about poker and you know about sort of the tournament grind and you know to place all of your focus on decisions and not outcomes, I think that's going to make him a very dangerous player. Another reason why I think he's dangerous, and we'll see if he can keep this up, and he actually credited you for this, Jonathan, and this line will be in the piece. He said one of the things about your tour run last year that inspired him to make this such a priority this year is the amount of fun that you had along the way. He said that's his style. Part of the reason he got out of poker was the total grind of it. He's looking to have a good time. I wonder if there's one thing I'm worried about is, like, when it gets down the stretch, I remember you last year having to go to tournaments that you wouldn't have ordinarily gone to try to protect your lead. I think he's just going to go to the ones he wants to go to. You think that's still a viable strategy for winning an event like the NHC Tour?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, at least to the time being, I think you might need to reevaluate that strategy come, you know, right around the time the Breeders' Cup starts, and there might be a couple of events you might want to just toss in. The thing about it is that if you put in the time, the effort, and the money into winning the tour, and you get to a point in which one or two trips here or there is going to protect your investment, it's almost like you have to do it. And sometimes people don't realize how much time and energy and finances they put into it until it starts to add up towards the end of the year. So I would imagine that tune might change as he gets a little bit closer. But I wasn't interested in forfeiting $50,000 for a relaxed weekend at home when I could hop on a plane and go hang out with some buddies at Surfside out in San Diego.
All right, makes sense. So that's definitely one of the stories to follow. There was, of course, some other racing this weekend other than the Oaks and Derby. Mike, doesn't have to be your favorite performance or your best performance, but what's an interesting performance from the weekend at Churchill Downs or elsewhere you feel like talking about here in our last quarter hour of the podcast today?
Boy, there was a lot of really good. I mean, we barely even mentioned Teppan, and I think we should take a minute to talk about her because, wow, how impressive was she? I mean, it's no surprise, obviously, but now they're talking about absolutely moving forward with a Royal Ascot, which I think is incredibly sporting, and it'll be really exciting to see her over there. That was amazing. I mentioned it before the show. There was a lot of people might have missed this because they were focusing more on the Churchill races, but C. Khaleesi, the French-bred filly for Chad Brown and Martin Schwartz, she was really impressive in the Sheepshead Bay. I thought she was last against a really, really slow early pace, and she just powered home, looked very good. I think she'll be a huge player on the filly and mare turf scene. Interestingly enough, she probably wants to go a little further than Teppan, but interestingly enough, Teppan's going to go over to Europe, and she's come over here. So she's one to watch that replay if you missed that one on Saturday.
It's one of those races that's visually impressive, and the numbers bear it out. If you take a look at the sort of late speed she demonstrated there relative to the overall final time of the race, I think you can make a fairly significant upgrade to any sort of raw time figure you'd want to come up with for C. Khaleesi. Definitely an obvious big contender in that division. Jonathan, I heard a rumor you might have had a chance to go see Teppan over the weekend. Did that happen? And tell us the circumstances and give us the story.
We did. Our buddy Norm Cassie was nice enough to let us come hang out, me and my four not that into racing friends. And we went and got to go check out the big horse. She had already gotten her share of peppermints that morning, so she wasn't too interested in us, but she looked amazing. We got to see the rest of the interesting characters of the Cassie Barn. World Approval apparently is the meanest horse in America, and we got to watch him act pretty good entertaining character that he was. But that was fun. So it was really cool to be able to see her. Feel really, really blessed to be able to see some really cool horses, Teppan, American Pharoah, Uncle Mo, to be able to get close to those horses. It's been some pretty cool stuff.
One of the thrills of the game. I mean, we talk about it so much from a betting point of view on the show, and with good reason. I mean, that's definitely a significant part of what drives interest. But it's something that, you know, this isn't just for big shots like Jonathan Kinchin to get to do. I mean, maybe to get the VIP treatment of going to the stall. But any racetrack in America, you know, especially one that's running top-class racing, that ability to go down to the paddock and just get in the world space of these beautiful equine athletes, it's part of what makes the game special and part of why so many contest players, including Jonathan, have made donations to help out the ones whose racing careers don't end in the breeding shed to keep them going. They're wonderful animals, and something, a point that, you know, I think that we try to make it a lot on the show, but you can never make it enough. In terms of other racing on the weekend, Jonathan, is there a particular performance that stands out to you, or one you want to talk about?
Well, and there's two. There's one that really stands out to me as wow, and there's the other one that's pretty wow, but I want to see what's going to happen moving forward. Karina Mia, wow, how impressive was she? Got away a little bit slower than I think her and Julian would have liked, and
for sure.
And was the definition, like the textbook definition of one for fun. Like, I mean, it was never in doubt, easy as she could have it, one for fun. So I think that was pretty awesome. I look forward to watching her moving forward. I mean, how awesome would it be if we could get her, Songbird, and Catherine Sophia in the same gate at some point?
That the Acorn, be maybe? Special. Is that a possibility?
I would hope so. That would be amazing. And then the other performance that I'm most interested in seeing what happens out of it is Sharp Azteca. I think that running as fast as that horse ran early and turning back the horses that I think he turned back, or the quality. I know that Mike and I kind of discussed that, you know, the quality of the field. I'm really interested to see what happens with that horse moving forward. If that performance was real, I think he might be the next, the 2016 version of Run Happy.
Let's pause there for a second. Mike, you were a little more skeptical about the form of the Sharp Azteca race. What's your case for that?
Well, Jonathan mentioned he thought he beat a bunch of really good horses in that race, and I don't know who he beat. I mean, it's a one-turn mile. He beat Discreetness, who I think is a better two-turn horse. Rallis, who, yeah, he won the Hopeful, but has not really run a step in any of his races since. You know, there were a couple. The big favorite in the race was that Bob Baffert horse, who got a huge buyer figure in the first career start.
American Freedom, his self-described horse for the Haskell. Imagining
yep,
those plans.
Yep. And that horse just didn't show up at all. You know, I mean, the 98 buyer in the first, if he ran to that, he'd be a huge player. And maybe, you know, I mean, it's too late to cross him off the list. I think if you're Baffert, you just say, okay, we didn't fire that day. Let's keep moving forward if the horse is sound and healthy. And he's probably going to bounce back, and he's probably better than what he showed in the Pat Day. But, you know, Sharp Azteca faced a field. You know, I didn't think there was really any, and certainly from a buyer figure standpoint, there were only two that had ever run in the 90s in their life, and one of them was that American Freedom. The other was the Pace Setter, who just completely collapsed. Sharp Azteca sat a great trip, ran on by him, you know, was able to hold off the closers. Look, he might be good, but based on the field that he beat, it's a little early in my mind to call him the next run happy.
Well, I thought the field was actually okay. I mean, I you know, after we had this conversation, I kind of started to look just to make sure I wasn't wrong or to help me feel better about my opinion. But there's seven graded stakes placed horses in the race, two listed stakes winners, and then American Freedom, the universal good thing Baffert horse who's supposed to be the next, you know, next coming from his barn. And so, you know, I think the field was fair enough. I think it was a lot of horses that were cutting back and doing something that I think they probably would prefer to do than going two turns on the Derby trail. And so I'm going to vote that it was a good race. But like you said, we'll find out soon enough if it wasn't.
Let's try to remember this conversation and come back to this at some point. You guys can have a little side bet for something on it. I don't know how we'll do it, but the form of the race and how it shakes out. You guys clearly have different opinions, and boringly, I'm somewhere in the middle.
Well, let's do it, because this is a race that, frankly, is, I think, a trumped-up allowance race. You've got most of the field eligible for non-winners of one other than, you know, another percentage non-winners of two other than, you know, and even the legitimate horses like Discreetness, I think, want further than a one-turn mile. I don't know.
But I do think that at this time of the year, though, that if they weren't eligible for an N1X or an N2X, then they would be in the Derby, because they've been running in race
prep.
They've been running in races against Derby horses for Derby prep. So if they were winning those races, they wouldn't be in this event. You know,
you can't make that point, Mike, about a restricted race for 3-year-olds at this time. I'm not saying you're wrong about your opinion of the race, but I don't think that's a legit knock.
Well, yeah, and I think that the Pat Day was a fallback plan for many of these horses, like Fellowship and Discreetness, and, you know, horses that probably want further than a one-turn mile, and certainly ran like that on Saturday. At least that's my take. You didn't have any competitive edges this year, or even Gimme the Lutes, you know, who were legitimate speed horses that had shown strong form in graded stakes, had shown that they probably weren't going to go the 10 furlongs of the Derby, whether or not they were eligible to from the point system. Regardless, you know, competitive edge, you didn't have that in this field.
All right, well, we're going to return to this. You know, we have a sort of competing thing between my opinion of the track and what the fractions were there. I mean, sometimes you do have those races where the pace is so fast, it makes everybody look bad, but the speed. I'll take that point, but we'll follow that field throughout the course of the year. Speaking of little intra-show competitions, the only winning I did all weekend, I think, was in our little our two podcast Derby contests. In one, the one that we sort of had jointly against Brent Sumja, I won that one. Except, did I really win that one? Because the bet was a dinner in Saratoga, and Sumja hasn't been seen in Saratoga in about 15 years, so I'm pretty sure he was just free-rolling on that one. Jonathan, I may make you buy me a burger at the Paddock Bar and broadcast it on Periscope to humiliate you if you don't mind too much. The other one is our Derby points contest. I know I did pretty well in that. Mike, did you bother to tally the actual results?
No.
But I'm looking pretty good.
I think.
I had the first. I had the first and the third. Who had Exaggerator?
It must be Jonathan because it wasn't me.
Or Larmy. We might not have taken him.
I didn't use.
No, we took him. Really?
Yeah, I think Larmy took him. That sounds right to me. We were all worried about the distance. So there you go. But all right, so Larmy, I suppose, in the hunt for that pick, but I'm looking pretty good.
Oh, I did have Exaggerator. Never mind. I'm wrong.
Okay, all right. Well,
I was going
to
say,
you're on the board. You have a chance to defend your bobblehead there. I have a feeling, Mike, at the end of this Triple Crown season, we're going to have to get we're both going to be getting bobbleheads, but we'll take a look, and we'll make sure that actually happens this year. And I'm not just saying that because I'm going to win. Any closing thoughts? We have some exciting stuff coming up in the next few days. Mike, we got webinars Thursday and Friday. Why don't you give people the rundown on what they can expect from each of those shows?
Yeah, it'll be fun. Tomorrow, Thursday, we have a formulated roundtable with a number of different players, including Elliot Honecker, who has been on the podcast before, also Barry Spears, Christopher Adu, who's a wagering ambassador for Santa Anita, and maybe another special. It might just be the four of us. Could be another special guest as well. Should be fun. It's really just, you know, we do these webinars. It's like me and Pete and maybe another DRF person. I wanted to reach out to the audience of players that use Formulator because there's so many different ways to do it. How do they approach a card? What are some of the things that they love about it? What are some of the things that they focus on most? How has it changed the way they handicap? And really just kind of make it easy for those, especially those who haven't used Formulator, to get over that barrier to entry, you know, that sort of thing. Very hopefully a very interactive session with a lot of the audience. And then on Friday, you know, Pete, maybe you could talk more about this one because this is one that I know is near and dear to your heart and I'm excited about as well.
Absolutely. We're going to be doing a webinar in conjunction with Betfair, who have already launched their platform in New Jersey. If you're an NJ Bets holder currently in the state of New Jersey, you're eligible to play on this new wagering exchange. We're going to do a little bit of a walkthrough. We're going to have Bart Barden from Betfair on with us to give some advice about how to get signed up, how to get up and running, and also talk about some basic strategies. I mean, this is a revolutionary thing to happen in American racing. At this point, New Jersey is essentially the canary in the coal mine for it, but we've got basically completely new concepts for American racing here, including the ability to bet fixed odds on the win, something that I think makes you much better as a fundamental handicapper when you have the opportunity to do. We're talking about the ability to lay or bet against horses, and then we're talking about different strategies regarding in-play wagering. That's right, you can now bet on the races while they're happening every step up to the wire. It's game-changing, potentially, really, really cool stuff, and I'm just excited to be a part of it, even in this small way. Make sure to join us for that webinar on Friday. We don't know the exact time, but it's going to probably be somewhere in the vicinity of 1 o'clock. Jonathan, did getting out of bed and doing the show, did it make you feel any better? Your voice improved throughout the course of the podcast. I'm hoping you're coming out of the post-Derby doldrums.
Yeah, I feel a little bit better, man. Thanks to you guys. Nothing gets me going like a little Pete and Mike in the morning. And I do. You got to get going sometimes. And it takes, you know, here's the thing. If you can handle losing and, like, it doesn't bother you, then good for you. But it drives me insane. And so and it forces me to try harder, work harder, do more, learn more, adjust more. And so I don't like losing. And when it happens, it puts me in a little bit of a funk, and then I work my way out of it.
That's why he's the champ, folks. But, Jonathan, do yourself a favor. Get some ice cream. Do something. We gotta get you back up in top form before the weekend. I want to thank Jonathan Kinchin. I want to thank Mike Hogan. I want to thank all of you for tuning in to this, the post-Derby edition of the DRF Players podcast. We will be back on Friday. May you win all your photos.